Please, can you enable screen share from Jessica? Should be the right one. Is that working? Yeah. Okay. Hi, everyone. I'm Emily. I'm a third or nearly fourth year PhD student in the Peshkovsky group in the Department of Plant Sciences, although our group's just moved out to the Crop Science Centre. And today I'm going to talk about my PhD project, and the title is Harnessing the Genetic Potential for Arbuscum Mycorrhizal Symbiosis in Rice. So I'll start with an overview of symbiosis. So arbuscum mycorrhizae are fungi that form a mutually beneficial symbiosis with plants, and they do it in quite a dynamic stepwise process where they produce these canonical structures. So it starts with a spore, and they make these extra radical hyphae, which are almost root-like structures that they use to go through the soil. And that allows them to move past root nutrient depletion zones. So they can get more nutrients than a sessile plant could out of its root system. And that's the reason that the plant allows the fungus to colonize and actually facilitates that colonization within its roots. So it attaches to the root surface with a trunk-like structure here, the hypopodia, and then moves either within or between the cells of the root into the inner cortex, where it forms arbuscules, which are highly branched tree-like structures where this nutrient transfer occurs. So the fungus gives the plant nutrients, mainly phosphate and nitrogen. And since it's mutually beneficial, the plant gives back its photosynthetic carbon, and that's in the form of lipids, usually fatty acids, that are stored in vesicles and also in the spores from right at the start, which allows the fungus to complete the life cycle and continue proliferating and colonizing plant roots. And that happens with the plant and fungus talking to each other and sending out signals to attract to each other. So as I said, it's mutually beneficial, and there's this exchange of carbon from the plant for mainly nutrients from the fungus. And that happens with around 80% of land plants that are present today. So there's huge potential for them to act as natural biofertilizers, which is what a lot of our research focuses on. So they could be important in low fertilization, sustainable agrosystems, because they have that natural fertilization ability and they're already present in the soil, and they associate with a large proportion of plants present. And the benefit that the plant gets from having the fungus within the root is dependent on the benefit it receives from that nutrient uptake, so how much it is good at doing that by itself anyway, versus benefiting from having the fungus there, minus the cost of giving away its own carbon. And there's been a lot of variation found in how much a fungus colonizes the plant and the benefit it gains from that, both between different species, and we focus mainly on crop species, or within a species and different varieties or cultivars. And an example in maize, where in superior lines had increased growth when they had the presence of the fungus, and they were gaining a lot of the phosphate from this symbiotic root. And another example, that dynamic stepwise process that I explained at the start is dependent on a suite of genes that are quite well known, and variation in one of those has been found in a wild rice variety to increase the amount of colonization and phosphate uptake, and therefore grain yield in a rice variety that has that different variant of the gene. So there's a genetic basis for how much colonization you plant gets and how much it benefits from it. And that's mainly what I look at. So I focus mainly in rice, and as everyone already knows, rice forms a large proportion of the world's food. It's a staple food source for a lot of people. It's grown in over 100 countries across 6 continents and in a wide range of environments. And this graph here just shows that, really, where you can have lowland rice, either irrigated or rain-fed, and that's shown in blue and yellow here. And upland rice, which is not in a paddy, but in aerobic conditions, also either irrigated or rain-fed, and that's found mainly in South America, across Africa, also in East East Asia, but that's also where you find a lot of the paddies. So fungi don't like water. So sorry, the colonization is low in flooded conditions. So we focus, when we talk about rice growth, on aerobic upland growth. An example in African field trials found that a lot of those upland cultivars had an increased growth rate when you have fungus present. So it's an example of how fungus can be used in these low fertilization agro systems, which are more sustainable because they have a reduced reliance on water, which is becoming a diminishing resource, and also on the amount of fertilizer, which also is becoming more difficult to mine. So that's the main question of my PhD, really, is what is the genetic basis for why there's variation in colonization and the benefit? And therefore, if we can identify that, we can identify varieties that are more likely to benefit from having fungus there in these sustainable agrosystems. So I've done a genome-wide association study interrogating that in a diverse rice lines. And just quickly, it's GWAS for short. Is a study that is designed to detect an association between genetic variants and a trait of interest. So that trait in my case is the amount of colonization. So here, as an example, you'd have a lot of diverse rice lines. Some would be highly colonized, some would be less, and some would be benefiting from that, and some wouldn't be. And connecting the genomes, putting those into groups and seeing what it is about the genomes of ones that, for example, have a high colonization, what that correlates to as a gene or a genetic region. So you use diversity panels so that you have a large variation in the genetics. And lucky for me, in 2018, there was an international effort led at the International Rice Research Institute in the Philippines, who I'm co-supervised by. It's called the 3KM Rice Genome Dataset. It was a collection of 3,000 rice accessions from 89 countries, which are shown here, the global distribution, and from different subpopulations. So that's the different colours here. So they're quite genetically diverse. They have a global distribution, and all of their genomes were sequenced. So we now have that as a big resource to go ahead and do this GWAS. And then secondly, GWAS, you look at a trait of interest. So mine is the amount of colonization, which we classically look at either by the expression level of that suite of genes that I mentioned at the start that we already know are associated to it, or by microscopy. So you can stain plant roots, and this blue stain or an ink stain will bind to the fungal cell wall so we can see it. And here, that's that highly branched arbuscal spore here, and we count the proportion of the different structures along a plant root to get the to determine the root length colonization. So these methods work well, but they're very time consuming and destructive. You have to take the root and cut it and stain it. So in my case, where I want a large experiment, I would need something more high throughput. And the year before I started my PhD, a lab in Germany who I collaborate with, it's in Jena in Germany, they found that a metabolite or compound is made in the root, and it correlates with the amount of colonization. And it's thought to travel to the shoot. So you can find it both in root and shoot material. And the benefit of that is that you can easily take a piece of the material and look at it on mass spectrometry. And here, this peak, that's the bluminol, and that the height of the peak would correlate, or the area under the peak, I should say, would correlate to the amount of colonization. So that's a massively throughput way of looking at colonization, which is perfect for my experiment. And at the time I started my PhD, this had been found to correlate in many crop species and many fungal species, but rice hadn't been tested. So the first part of my PhD was checking that correlation was maintained in rice. And I grew experiment with so that I would have different levels of colonization in rice, which is this bottom axis here. And then I took the shoot material of the same plants and measured the bluminol. And as you can see here, A, B, and C are three different cultivars of rice, and the correlation was maintained. And again, since in my case, I'm going to be using that 3K RISE data set from all over the world, then I took a subset of that that was sent over from IRI. And again, it correlates. So that was good news to say that I could use it for my experiment. So I can't use the 3,000 lines because it would be too big of an experiment. So I need to narrow it down and choose about 200 to go ahead and look at. And these are the ones I picked. So you can see the color is the subpopulation of rice. The size of the dot is the number of lines at that location. And you can see there's quite a distribution both in subpopulation and in global distribution across the world. So that should reflect what the 3000 project aimed to do, but now narrowed down to 200 to make it easier for experiments. And these are a subset of some of the rice that I was sent from the Philippines. And already you can see the diversity between the lines. So quite obviously there's some that are red and some that are white. These ones are more kind of short and chubby compared to a longer one that's a bit more like a basmati, I guess. So there was quite a lot of diversity already just in the seeds. And I grew these genotypes that I was sent both with and without the fungus. That's what Mock and Nick will mean from now on. And five replicates of each, which totaled 2,100 plants. So it was a massive experiment, which was initially supposed to happen in the Philippines, but COVID kind of took that away. So luckily I managed to do it at the Botanic Garden and with the help of the staff there and our staff at Plant Sciences. So these plants, there's 2,100 plants there that grew for 8 weeks, all with those diverse genotypes. So just another subset, this is them at 8 weeks old, and you can already see that some of them are quite short and there's quite a diversity in the height. There's also a diversity in the color. This one's quite hard to tell, but it was purple, which was very exciting. And also in how they grow. So these kind of grew upwards with thicker leaves, or you had some that had thinner leaves and grew outwards, almost like a branching of a tree. So the plants were diverse, was the moral of that story. And you can see that this is the mean height of the plants at 4 weeks old here. This line here is a reference of a line called Nipponberry, which we normally use for experiments in the lab. So you can see that there's a distribution in the height of the different cultivars that I grew. And so the aim of the GWAS was to look at AM colonization level in those plants, and then also to measure the benefit that they would be getting from colonization, which is why I also measured factors such as height of the plant, the shoot weight, nutrient analysis of the shoot, the root as well, and then the benefit from that is basically the difference between having the fungus and not over not having the fungus. So as an example, I've just started to get this data in now. For root weight, I measured both the fresh weight and the dry weight, and I'll continue with the results for dry weight just for the interest of time. But this is what they look like. So we really did just cut the root from the shoot and dry them and weigh them. So you don't have to look at this in detail, but basically this is all of the different genotypes that were grown. Purple is Mock and yellow is Mick. And it's just to show that what we're looking for is whether that those partners are the same and there was not very much difference between whether the plant had the fungus or not, or whether it benefited. In this case, that looks like it could have slightly benefited, or the opposite way around. It was negatively affected by having the fungus there. So that's the kind of data that I'm starting to analyze now to look at that benefit that it would gain or not from having the fungus. And again, there's a distribution. Anything below this line in gray looks like a negative response to having the fungus there, and above is positive. But again, this is just preliminary data that needs fully analyzing. But it's looking quite promising that there is quite a lot of variation in the benefit that they saw from the fungus. And then I can start to look at whether there's differences in the global distribution, whether that determines whether you benefit positively or negatively. Red is negative here and more blue is positive, and purple's kind of antagonistic. So you, I've start looking at that for each of those factors that I measured, but again, this is all in the pipeline for the next few weeks, really. And so the next steps, I've done the experiment, I've colonized the roots, and now need to measure the level. So that will be the next few months, working with that lab in Germany that found the bloom knolls. And then I'll correlate the amount of colonization to the genetics to see if you can disentangle the genetic region or gene responsible for that. So that means that you know the genetic regions leading to increased colonizational benefit, which means that you can produce the best lines for growth of the upland rice with AMF. And that, as I said at the start, would reduce the reliance on high input fertilization farming and irrigation systems, which are becoming more difficult to maintain. So that's the goal, really. And just to thank everyone that's helped with, it's been a massive project, obviously, just from the number of plants. So thank you to my group and to ITA, and especially the GWAS harvesters. It was a massive experiment, and that week of harvesting I couldn't have done without the whole lab, some of my housemates, some other PhD students. So thank you to all of them and the staff for the growth. Amelia Henry is my supervisor in the Philippines, and Ian, Reiko and Anna are the lab in Germany who helped with all the bloom knoll work. And thank you to the BBSLC for funding. And thank you everyone for listening.
Thank you. Thank you, Emily. It's really fascinating. I did have I remember a very quick summary of the ECR event. but you've gone a lot more into detail. We had only a few minutes. It's great to hear more about it. If I may start just with a quick question then. So if we go for this colonized rice, right? It probably is not the right term to use, but which doesn't require water or irrigated in the same way, right? Then I suppose that's also an answer to climate change, because the rice cultivated in flooded area does contribute to climate change. I can't remember the percentage, but so is this something that, you know, is being pushed as well and discussed in your work as a sort of a way of, you know, kind of promoting it, essentially?
Yeah, it's definitely a reason, you know, for the focus on this more sustainable agri-system for growth. Obviously, a large proportion of the rice grown at the moment is in paddies, which, you know, are contributing to climate change. And, you know, the idea is that they require a massive input, both in fertilizer and water, that is not going to become sustainable in the future. And also just so whether that makes a big switch over to upland will depend on that. But also the upland depends on their upland varieties, but some are rain fed depending on where they are, and some are irrigated. So it will also depend on the land that's available and how sustainable the farming practices could become, and who's doing them, really, whether it's small farmers or, you know, a large input. So, yeah, the goal is that it would be really beneficial, especially to upland cultivars, to start introgressing this into breeding programs. But whether it would overall replace paddy rice, that's, I mean, a massive proportion of rice growth at the moment.
But could that be?
Oh, I've lost Francesca.
Could that rice be produced in the same areas? Can you hear me?
You're freezing a bit.
The connection is unstable. I'm freezing. Can you hear me now? I'll let others talk. Enough of me.
Well, can I come in with a quick question, which is slightly tangential to your main theme, Emily, but great talk, thank you. I was just interested in the kind of phylogeography that, I mean, for most genetic patterns you'd anticipate a lot more diversity in China, where rice has been for thousands of years, than America, where rice has been for hundreds of years. And obviously that wasn't the main theme we were talking, but just out of interest, do you see those that geographical patterns in diversity that reflect the history of the crop or not?
It has been seen before, yeah. There's definitely, I mean, I don't know specifically about geography, but definitely between the modern and the wild, yeah. There's a huge diversity, obviously, because of domestication. And there is diversity between upland and lowland rice, again, like how they're grown and how that's domesticated in it. And those practices are quite specific, as you saw in that graph, to East Asia seems to be a lot of the paddy and lowland, whereas the upland is found in across Africa and South America. So that will, I undoubtedly will reflect in the genetics.
Yeah, but you haven't got something like, in another narrative, you might have a founder effect in America, whereby the American genetics is all uniform because of a historically recent founder effect. But you had different colored dots in America, so it looks like there's a fair bit of variety in America too.
Yeah. And there's quite a difference between rice that there's a few founders in Africa versus over in East Asia. So there's also that split. Yeah, but I'm not an expert on the whole.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Any questions?
Can I come in? Is that okay?
Of course.
Thank you, Emily, for a really wonderful presentation. But I want to, I'm not I'm not a scientist, so I'm going to obviously talk a little bit from my perspective of social science. And I'm just, very curious of a few points you raised about, basmati, for instance. And I just wonder why specifically basmati has been chosen here.
It wasn't actually basmati. It's just that it looks more like it. I mean, basmati.
Yeah, but I saw on the map that you showed there's a component of basmati in one of the.
One of the subpopulations. So in that 3,000, the accessions that they chose, one of the subpopulations is called basmati. So yeah, that will be where they get basmati rice, but actually I didn't focus on that at all. Mine was called indica because they're most likely to be the upland cultivars.
Yeah, so what I'm trying to sort of understand is, there's obviously some differences in the outcome of the experiments that you're doing and whether we can specifically say that there's going to be more beneficial, less beneficial, if there's that kind of description that we can attach to different varieties of rice, and then that corresponds to different kinds of vulnerabilities that we are seeing in the ecosystem as well as in the lives of the farmers who are actually going to benefit from these experiments. So I was just wondering whether it's worthwhile looking at specifically upland varieties with respect to what is now called the mountain vulnerabilities. Very specifically, ecologically, mountain varieties are more vulnerable. And also, in terms of indigenous crop varieties, which is the other side of the more kind of genetically modified ones, what would be the outreach for that? How many indigenous varieties are being brought into when the selection is happening from Filipino end? I'm just wondering how far the Crop Research Institute is interested in developing or bringing the experiment to these indigenous varieties, where there are different levels of resistance here, whether it's pest resistance or resistance from farmers who want to actually adopt these experiments. So I'm just trying to understand whether these factors are taken in when you're actually choosing those of the 300 that has been chosen. So what is actually informing the choice or the selection of that? If there's any information on that, because obviously you're doing it from scientific perspective where you're dealing with the samples that are sent,
yeah,
I would want to know what is behind the selection of those samples.
So Erie has...
Is it best? What is actually driving it?
Yeah, so the way the 3K, the whole 3000 was a collaboration between the Chinese Academy of Sciences and Erie, but it was made to include the mega varieties grown over a million hectares or the parents of popular varieties, but also bringing back the wild varieties, or I assume the indigenous varieties. But that was the idea, was to basically represent all rice, you know, or as much of that diversity that we can in that panel. And the whole of Erie works on these 3,000, each on a different thing. As you said, the disease pests more, and we're on the beneficial fungus side and the photosynthesis, and all of it is all now. That's the idea of having this panel, is to look so you can say, know everything about a variety. And then in terms of improving indigenous ones, that would be by doing this research anyway, you'd know the genetic traits to be able to to use that to make an indigenous variety, you know, more susceptible to the fungus. Whether that actually happened or you chose a different variety because it was better at other things as well, you know, the integration into the breeding program is the idea, is to put them into the best lines. Whether it was it still has the potential to go into an indigenous line, it's whether that is worth it in those, you know, where it's going to be grown. The way I chose my 200 was purely based on the genetics and the global distribution, trying to keep as much of that diversity as possible. Sure. Erie has the information available of where they've got it from. I don't know, I've never seen it say, I think it's only ever said upland. I hadn't heard of the mountain or indigenous ones. I don't know whether it goes as far as classifying that.
Yeah, see, that's where I feel that, you know, the way things are clubbed, like upland variety, what in other researches that I'm involved in, one of the GCRF funded projects deals particularly on indigenous varieties of rice up in the Himalayas, which is we're trying to find different varieties there that are probably not botanically classified in the more kind of scientific way that we would like to. But this is all kind of knowledge that exists with people who are up there and actually cultivate that based not on seed banks that are more formalized, but there's informal seeds that are being collected as well. And the question here is, you know, how do we also include those practices and those varieties to be brought into these kind of more kind of genetic experiments, which would probably benefit from point of sustainability, and whether upland varieties, you know, are also inclusive of these mountain varieties that I'm talking about, high altitude practices, more so than terraced cultivations probably. So yeah. Okay, I mean, we have to keep that in mind, that the you know, whether the traits in the indigenous varieties are actually more conducive to the kind of experiments that are doing, therefore is more naturally adapted, or we are seeing that some genetic varieties are more responsive than others. So, you know, whether those wild varieties are more responsive or not is basically the correlation I'm trying to find out here.
Thank you, Sanjukt. I think, Emily, do you want to add anything else?
I think, I mean, obviously it would be beneficial to include every rice variety we have in the panel, but the idea of the panel is that it's so diverse that it allows you to disentangle the genetic region that would be responsible for it, which means that I later on could look in those indigenous varieties and say, oh, does it have it or not? Mm-hmm. So I guess it depends at what point you would want to include, you know, the idea for a GWAS is to have diversity, which I have from those panels, And then later on, it allows you to zoom into the genetics of any rice, as long as you have the genome sequenced, which I guess it, if they're that, you know, not yet classified, they probably don't have the genome sequence, which means it's more difficult to work on than something that's coming from a seed bank.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. John. Thank you.
Emma, that was a very well presented talk. Yeah, I really enjoyed it. Thank you. I have a kind of a sort of double layer question. And the first one is about these bloominals. I'm always interested in things that move systemically around plants. So the first part is mechanically, what's the basis of them only moving systemically through the whole plant so that you can, I guess you've shone a light on these plants or something. What's the mechanism that distinguishes a colonized plant from a non-colonized plant that allows this chemical to move? And actually, maybe another rider question, could this be somehow a good way of selectively introducing some beneficial chemical? But the main question was, the bulk of your results use very respectable conventional measures of plant performance, you know, growth and gain of mass and things like that. So, and you didn't actually mention any bloominal work, you just introduced it as a methodology. So what's the advantage of the bloominal? It can't be surely as quantitative as what you did. So I'll be quiet now. There's like 2.5 questions in there.
So thank you. The bloominal work is coming next. So at the moment, the only results I have to show you is those measurements that I said, but the whole point of the GWAS really is to correlate that to the amount of colonization. So that'll be exciting to get those bloominal measurements, per every genotype. So the systemic movement, the evidence for that is still quite limited. So it's based upon root and it's expressed in leaf and root, or it's found. Genes that are thought to be involved in the biosynthesis are also expressed in those. But bloominal has been found in xylem sap. So that's the majority of the evidence for that systemic movement. So it still needs...
Well, it's really not the evidence for systemic movement, because if it moves, hey, it's systemic. It was really, what's the mechanism by which only the colonized plants will become presumably glow in the dark versus those that are not colonized?
So still unknown. So even the genes involved in the biosynthesis, some of them have been found. So they're related to stragalactones. It's all the similar pathway. So I looked, and stragalactones, it was on a slide, but I didn't really specifically mention it, are involved in attracting the fungus to the rice root. So I've looked at some of the biosynthesis genes of stragalactone, and it's quite interesting. So one of the stragalactone biosynthesis genes, a mutant in that D27, makes colonization really low, and bloominal is still really high. So it's not actually that you need bloominal to be colonized. So we're not sure what it's doing. It's thought to be required for arbuscule turnover, but again, the evidence is still we're not sure.
Okay, I apologize, because I misunderstood. So I thought it was a synthetic chemical that you were adding rather than, is it made by the fungus or the plant?
The plant.
But the fungus stimulates its production.
Yeah.
Oh, how cool. They're very interesting. Thank you.
And it was found by accident. So the whole thing's really cool.
Okay. My favorite kind of experiment. Thank you.
So Emily, could you then add this fungus then artificially? As now John has hinted, could that be added to the plant?
Yeah, you can add the fungus exists naturally in the soil, but you can add it anyway. You can buy it in supermarkets. It's often added to rose food. And you couldn't, this evidence that bloominal's not really required for having, you know, having Blumenol in that mutant didn't mean that it was highly colonized. So what Blumenol would do if you added it, it still wouldn't, I'm not sure.
Anyone else would like to contribute?
I just wonder, Emily, how much is known about the fungal genetic diversity globally?
There's quite a lot of work on it. It's quite hard to manipulate the fungus because you can't do any kind of GM in it. But yeah, the diversity within the species, there's it's starting to be sequenced. So we have our model that we use quite a lot, but there are quite different ones. So ours is called Rhizophagus irregularis because it's quite obviously inside the root and you see those arbuscules everywhere. There's another Gigasporer that has this massive spore outside and a lot less of the arbuscules. So they're diverse just in the way that they colonize and the distribution of those structures. But yeah, experimentally, like in our case, we use like a model fungus. So that's what we focus on, but there is work on the diversity.
Thanks.
Anyone else? Any more comments? Uta, do we still have Uta?
Yeah, no, I just actually wanted to comment or congratulate Emily on having that persistence through what has been really difficult period. I mean, besides the fact that this is a massive endeavor that she embarked on with this Jivas, and normally the idea would have been that she would have been helped by ERI because the whole Jivas experiment would have been grown on the Philippines with quite a number of technical help. And she was not discouraged at all by COVID and all of the associated complications and found a way to actually move the project forward and do it here, which was not obvious at all. So I think this is in the process of being rewarded with some really nice data. At least that's what we believe at the moment. There's still more mining to be done and again, also in collaboration with ERI. So congratulations for having that persistence and having done a really, really brilliant job.
Thank you.
Yes, I agree. It must have been quite difficult. I'm sure the conditions at the Botanic Gardens are not the same.
It was very hot that week. But the staff were amazing. So yeah, we sorted it out.
Right. Anyone else? Any comments or questions? Emily, do you want to add anything else that you've missed out or you would like to add?
I think that's it.
Yeah. Thank you so much, then. It's been really interesting. Thank you. Thank you, everyone, for joining. And I hope that, we will see you next week, hopefully. And have a good weekend.
Thanks very much.
Bye. Thank you, Emily.
Bye.
Thank you. Bye. Thank you, everyone. Bye.